Welcome to EIR Talks. On February 16, 2002, EIR's founding editor, Lyndon LaRouche, addressed the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute and International Caucus of Labor Committees. This week, we bring you LaRouche's responses to questions during the third session.
Do we have any proof that anybody or any country was involved in this event? Is our democracy allowing us to discriminate against other people, religions, and culture as the head of the Justice Department, Mr. Ashcroft, said in public that he was comparing between Islam and Christianity, and he said, Islam is the religion God asks you to send your son to die for his sake. And Christianity is the faith that God sent his son to die for you. I think that when something like this comes from someone like Mr. Ashcroft, is against our democracy, because this basically allow anybody else to discriminate against people without proof and without evidence. And I think democracy is something different than that. Okay, so here we are the people of the United States. We are the people paying the price for this war against terrorism with no evidence. We pay the price out of our tax money and out of our respect to ourselves and to our society and to our system. If we would like to go in war against terrorism, first question is, who is considered as a terrorist? And who is a terrorism? And if we answer this question, we can go to the other question. Basically, Arab and Muslim are defined as terrorism in the media of the Western countries, not only after September 11, but way back in the history before that. If we remember, when the Oklahoma City bomb happened, was the first reaction also Muslim and Arab people did it. And we find lately this was not the truth. And the reason that the media point to the Muslim and Arab people as a terrorism is the conflict in the Middle East. If we wanna define who is the terrorism, is Mr. Sharon and our government supporting him with money, $4 billion from your tax dollars, if you will pay taxes anymore anyways, because I don't think that you will have jobs. If we support Israel with aircrafts, F-16s, and helicopters Apache, and the tanks, and we supporting this regime in Israel to destroy homes and kill people, innocent people, every single day, and we blindly don't think and don't see this as a terrorism, and we defined the people in Palestine defending their land and their lives as a terrorism and put them in the top priority list of our government to go after to fight and pay our money to fight these groups, who is a terrorism? Who is supporting terrorism? Okay, Mr. Bush and his administration have a long, long list of countries and groups were defined as terrorism. 60 of them. Mostly are Muslim and Arab countries and organizations. So,
could Mr. LaRouche begin to address this?
I would. Okay, I will be brief, and I will try to end my question very soon. I would like to know what Mr. LaRouche thinks about the clash of civilization and Armageddon war that it's supposed to destroy 2/3 of the international population for Jesus Christ, the prophet, to come back. I would like to have an answer if God wants us to fight each other here, and the prophet Jesus Christ was described in the Quran that he was the prophet of peace, will be happy to come back after we kill each other. I would like to end by saying, Mr. LaRouche, thank you for inviting everybody to have a dialogue in a state of clash of civilizations. And I can promise you that even if you are not in power in the White House right now, and maybe you will not be next election, because we all know who support the other sides. But I can promise you that history will have a lot of respect for you and your group and people going along with your ideas. History will have disrespect to the other groups like the fascism and the Nazism, as the history have no respect to Hitler and Mussolini. Thank you all.
I can respond briefly to this, because first of all, on the question of the clash of civilizations, what I've written is clear. I do not disagree with the observations, obviously, that were made just now, and the series of indictments against the policy. I would phrase them differently in many cases, but I don't disagree with the argument. I would say, instead of objecting to what the enemy is doing, I say we have to, in a sense, eliminate the essential enemy. The enemy is not necessarily a person. The enemy is an agency of evil. People have been talking about axes of evil and this and that. There is an agency of evil. That evil on this planet is a commitment by certain forces to establish a regime, a caricature of the Roman Empire, which is universal fascism. Our job is to expose the character of that movement for universal fascism, and to destroy the power of that movement by mobilizing the people of the world to understand what the choice is. The choice is not the crimes. For example, the case of Israel is a perfect example. We now have over 200 signatories, reservists of the Israeli military, who are in the leadership of a revolt against the murderous policies of Sharon. Therefore, our concern is not only to oppose evil, which Sharon and the IDF leadership certainly represents, but is to defeat evil decisively by educating and mobilizing those who can be educated and mobilized to realize this is not an injustice by the U.S. government. This is an injustice which has taken control of the U.S. government. And we have to free this government from the control by that injustice. The way we do that is essentially moral and political, by educating people as to the nature of the danger. I have great confidence in people. I often been given reason to believe otherwise, but I retain that confidence, that in the end, man is made inherently good by birth. And there has to be a time and place and way in which the goodness inside the human individual can be brought forth to cause evil to be righted. I would say one other thing on this question. Rather than saying that as a generality, I would add this. Look at the condition of mankind. Mankind has been on this planet for maybe 2 million years as man. We know that from artifacts which we can date, which were created by a human mind, not an ape. Look at the condition that mankind has gone through. Look at what happened to mankind since in historic times, since the Ice Age melt, which began between 19,000 and 12,000 years ago. See the rise of civilizations, or so-called. See the rise and fall of peoples. See the great evils that were done. But nonetheless, see today that there's a certain cumulative triumph of humanity over evil, which is not completed, but remains to be completed. If we look at the history of human progress, despite the evil, despite the dark ages, despite the destructions of entire national civilizations, we see that in the end, the good is tending to triumph. What we must do is try to accelerate the process of triumph of the good.
You want to speak to that? Danny Baer had a question for Helga from the student meeting.
Actually, the question was for Lynn. Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge, was really mentally blocked. When he was confronted by charity, they asked, if you don't give for these people, they might die. And he said, good, surplus population. It might help curb it. Later, he's confronted by his old business partner, Jacob Marley, who's tied down with all the chains of the things that he'd created throughout his life, ledgers, money chests, and whatnot. And Scrooge asks him, how can you be so unhappy? You were so good at your business. And Marley replies, my business? That was a bit of my professional trade was just a teaspoon in the ocean of my business, which should have been devoted to the common good of everyone. And so he sends this intervention by these three spirits who have a serious edge to him. They ridicule him for his comments about surplus population. They show him about where things are going to end up if things continue this way. And so Scrooge goes through this profound change where he's so happy by the end he's tangled up in his stockings like the Laocoon, and he's vowed that he's going to live his life for all the past, the present, and the future. And so with trying to convey an idea to somebody, there seems to be a conscious kind of a decision about whether you're going to go for, as I usually just kind of go for the nice ideas. And sometimes it seems like that's the way to answer some things, but other times there's a serious tragedy element to it. So is that something that you consciously choose, or is it something that has to be developed, or would it be better off for someone whose talents are maybe more in fairy tales and comedy to focus on that, or does everybody need to be able to have a serious edge at sometimes? Because I seem to lack that.
Well, what would the Dickens was wrong with England, That actually the Dickens was a courageous person of insight, writing in difficult times, and he tried to do a job. And he became a part of the English-speaking culture, and justly so. I think many of us who, in the days when we still read books in schools, we benefited from that sort of thing. But the issue is this. The problem is, how do you come to believe in the good? People have a sense of right and wrong in the sense of rules. That some things are good and some things are bad. You believe that they are bad or relatively good. Sometimes you believe that you have to put up with the bad. You have to be realistic. You have to be pragmatic. You have to go along with popular opinion. But you know, regrettably, that you're going along with the bad. But because it's popular opinion, you have to go along with popular opinion. Otherwise, people won't like you. So where's the efficiency of this process of fighting for the good? Now, let's take the case of a scientist. And this is just an example. A scientist who makes a discovery of a universal physical principle. If you think about scientists, real scientists who make these kinds of discoveries, and you've gone through the work of many of them, as I have, you realize that they started out with certain propositions, paradoxes, which they set out to solve. And they committed most of their life to solving these paradoxes, these challenges. And they solved in the course of their life several times. But look at the amount of time that was spent by virtually every important discoverer in developing that discovery. In other words, you don't make a discovery as an inspiration, as a thought, as a hypothesis of a moment. Ah, now I see. Now I've got to construct the experiment and prove that it's true. Not so simple. To prove that something is not only true, in the sense that you can experimentally demonstrate something to do that, but that it's universally true, occupies the better part of a lifetime of work, sometimes by many people working together. There are many cases in science. I won't bother going through it here, but time will run out. But the point is this. What about the experience of the person who goes through the cognitive process, which may span over years, or relives as a student the experience of someone who actually made such a discovery, or several people who made such discoveries? Like the work of Kepler. Read the work of Kepler, for example. From his Mysterium Cosmographicum to his harmonic, world harmonics. Read that, and you find in that period, that span of his lifetime, from the beginning of a germ of a discovery, the development of the hypothesis, the experimental proof of the hypothesis, which was proven completely by him to a certain degree, then was developed further through the work of Fermat, of Huygens, of Leibniz and others, which was not completed until the work of, in a sense, even partially until the work of Riemann following Gauss. Now, if you as a student have followed that history of the discovery of principle and realize that the ideas which are generated and validated through cognition and experimental method are efficient. They enabled man to increase his power per capita in the universe in terms that would have been unimaginable prior to that time. And you have a sense of the power of ideas. See, the problem with people who believe in the good is they don't believe in the power of ideas. And therefore, when they're confronted with a challenge, they say, well, maybe you have a good idea, but people aren't going to go along with it. You say, wait a minute, buddy. These ideas are not simply choices like pieces on a delicatessen. Not a smorgasbord. You can pick this and pick that and pick that. That's not the nature of ideas. Ideas, real ideas, represent real power. They represent universal power. And when people get a sense of the kind of ideas that represent inherently power, then they have confidence in those ideas, and they don't flinch in the face of public opinion. Any scientist who capitulated before public opinion was not worth a hill of beans. People whose opinions are shaped by public opinion are people whose opinions are not worth a hill of beans. And now we have a lot of people running around with ideas, but their ideas are not worth a hill of beans because they have no sense of the power of ideas, and therefore know that the mere public opinion is a nothing compared to the authority of the power of valid ideas. That's where the problem lies.
Julian Bruno from Austin, Texas, had lined up here at the mic a moment ago.
Hello, Lynn. Hello, Helga. Thank y'all for your work. Yeah, I have two questions. One, in talking to people, I periodically get these answers about there's only this spiritual solution to things, and there's no effort or no desire on their part, or they're just hopeless about the situation and think that there's no political solutions to what's going on and creating a new monetary system and all. So I'd like to comment on that if you would. And then the other thing that I'd like for you to clarify is the issue you have against, as I'm understanding some of the readings, of Gnosticism. Because when I read some different books, like of Matthew Fox's book on original blessing, and there's this great list of what may be called Christian mystics, they exemplify a certain man created in the image and likeness of God and the universal principles that Helga was speaking of earlier today better than anybody, like Hildegard of Bingham and Julian of Norwich and Jesus and other figures. So if you could clarify the issue that you have against Gnosticism, because when I think of the word, some of its root meaning knowledge, having a sense of knowledge, I want you to clarify that, if you would, those two things. Thank you.
Well, the problem is on Gnosticism is the word actually does not mean knowledge. It means knowledge which is not based on knowledge. It means essentially mysticism. That is, for example, this comes up in most of the religious sects in the United States, some nominally Catholic, some Protestant, are largely essentially Gnostic. What I referred to, the case of Belloc, the case of, discussing that earlier, the case of Chesterton, that crowd, they are essentially Gnostics. They are not Christians in any sense. What's the meaning? In Christian theology, the term spiritual, that is in theology, the spiritual means the same thing that it means in Plato's dialogues. A spiritual exercise is a cognitive experience which is based on being confronted with a paradox which is unassailably a paradox. It's not an illusion, it's a real paradox. For example, the fact that light in some ways is refracted through the air, when it's projected from the air, is reflected in equal angles. When it's refracted instead through another medium from the air, it's refracted in a different way. These are both involve the refraction of light. They're both observed with the senses as refraction or the equivalent of refraction. They should be the same, the sense perception says. But they're not the same. That light actually follows in refraction quickest time. And when you've made the discovery that proves that, it proves that light in reflection is also following quickest time, not shortest distance. So the principle of quickest time rather than shortest distance is demonstrated to be a principle. This is a very elementary thing in science, this question, as posed by Fermat and treated on isochronic principles and so forth by later discoverers such as Huygens and so on. But therefore, spirituality does not pertain to inspiration, antic inspiration, arbitrary belief. Spirituality always involves deep questions of unassailable paradoxes. That is, they are unassailably paradoxes. They call into question the authority of the senses, and they show that the solution to these problems cannot be discovered through sense perception, but can be discovered through scientific methods of hypothesis and experimental proof. Therefore, the power to change man's power over the universe through science comes as a spiritual act. Now, you have to understand what you mean by spirit. Spirit does not mean something outside the universe. Spirit means that the power of cognition, or the nature of God as creativity, is always in the universe, and that quality is also an efficient quality of the human mind, and only the human mind, not that of the animals. Therefore, we call the act of discovery of a valid physical principle, universal physical principle, a spiritual act. That defines the meaning of spirit. There are other kinds of experiences which have the same kind of significance because they have the same quality of generation. But the physical experimental one is the easiest one to use as a point of illustration. Therefore, there are no mysteries. They don't exist. There are unknowns. But there are no things that exist mysteriously outside the comprehension of the human mind. The human mind can understand. For example, when I've discussed several times during this conference the question of the nature of human identity, and I say the identity of man must be, if man understands himself, that your identity is located in the immortality within your mortality. That is, through your cognitive powers and by doing useful things for mankind, for the past and for the future as well as the present, through your cognitive powers, you are important to all humanity, formerly existing, present, and future. Therefore, you have an immortal self-interest in doing the things which make your having lived meaningful. When you have that viewpoint, then you locate your interest not in your sense perceptions, not in your physical gratifications, but you locate your identity in the cognitive powers typified by the ability to make an original scientific discovery of universal principle.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of Lyndon LaRouche speaking to the Schiller Institute Conference of February 16, 2002. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Lyndon LaRouche addressing the President's Day Conference, February 16th in Reston, Virginia.
That doesn't mean you always have to make it originally yourself, but you have to go through the original experience of replicating what has been done by somebody else. That is, when you actually experience what happened in the mind of Archimedes or any other famous discoverer, as in school, and you live through the act of discovering that universal principle, you have gone through what would be classified in theology as a spiritual exercise, whose other name is a cognitive exercise as opposed to a deductive exercise. And that, when you say that, then you see that all the idea is that there are mysterious forces out there that we couldn't understand, which are operating from underneath the floorboards of the universe, and that if you propitiate them, good will come to you, is like the guy who's shooting crap in a corner. And he's gambling, you know, and the other gamblers are there. And he said, you know, God, give me those, you know, give me seven. Hoping that somehow a force from outside reality is going to manipulate those dice and cause them to come in his favor at the crap table or at the Las Vegas gambling table. And that's what the Gnostics do, is they talk about things that they feel good about and say these are good. As, for example, it's like a typical, you run into Texas, a lot of them, these so-called fundamentalists, who believe that the Battle of Armageddon will lead to the rapture and they won't have to pay the rent next month. I mean, that is what I mean by mysticism, as opposed, as as opposed to spiritual. But a spiritual exercise is a very important thing. It is the basis of all human civilization. And therefore, when you to understand these problems, you have to be able to confront one thing. Are you willing to realize, is your moment-to-moment experience, as sense-perceptual experience, a pleasure and pain experience, from moment to moment in life, even to the pain of dying, is only that. It's only a mortal experience. That what is important, and when people become older and wiser, they begin to appreciate that. What is important is what your life means for humanity, and implicitly, what it means in the service of God.
Five questions have been emailed in from Peru, and I'd like to just ask, string three of them together. They're different, but they're all from Peru. if I may. I'll abbreviate somewhat. Sara Madueño, a leader of our movement in Peru, writes, about 20 people are gathered here in the EI office in Lima following the conference closely. Another group is listening in the northern Peruvian city of Sullana, and many other friends are listening at home. My question is this. Bush has announced he will visit Peru in March. The press is speculating that the real motive is for the U.S. to set up a military base in the Peruvian jungle, given the imminent escalation of the war against narco-terrorism in Colombia. How do you evaluate this scenario? Is it part of Bush's phase two against terrorism? Is it a concession to one worldist concept of limited sovereignty, or is it a matter of making common cause against a common enemy? How do you distinguish beyond doubt? And may I put the other two together? I think they're not the same, but there's a kinship. That's from Sara Madueño. Jorge Angeles Torres writes or asks, is it possible for our country, Peru, to implement a modern economic system without the support of the government, the IMF, and the World Bank? And how to overcome the economic crisis in our neighbor, Argentina. And finally, Eduardo Edgar Chavez Collantes asks, communications media are promoting movies inducing paganism under the guise of entertainment, Dungeons and Dragons, Harry Potter, and Lord of the Rings. How dangerous is it for youngsters and children to watch? How do they harm the mind? What danger lurks behind fantasy literature such as Tolkien?
Well, these things are, the latter one, they're dangerous mostly to younger children and to adolescent children. Because particularly in adolescence, they take one form in young children and a slightly different form in adolescent children. In young children, they become dangerous because they destroy the sense of reality. Because the child gets an emotional attachment or an emotional experience in an escapist, totally escapist mode. And that destroys the cognitive powers of the child. For example, the worst example of this, which is only illustrates the point for literature, is the Nintendo game, like Pokemon. The Nintendo game with young children turns the child into a homicidal killer. And they may not all become homicidal killers, but the propensity which results from a conditioning by playing Nintendo games habitually is to produce a killer. And that child may, by playing Nintendo games, may be able to one day, after having never used a weapon, as has occurred, one day pick up a pistol, which he's never handled before, and shoot somebody accurately with headshots. And this is a result of a Nintendo game. The problem on younger children, particularly pre-puberty children, is precisely that danger, that you're going to produce a bunch of more immoral zombies from your own children. And that's not a good idea. Now, with the adolescent, it becomes dangerous in a different way. And it becomes dangerous in the way that some other kinds of recreation do the same thing. That they create escapism. Now, what's the problem, the biggest problem, and we were discussing this among some of the younger people today, greatest problem we face, that people, even of the baby boomer generation and younger generations today, do not believe in reality. You see, you want to discuss reality? Let's drop the subject. What they're interested in is gimmicks, escapist gimmicks. They have a lifestyle. What's happening in the real world is of no concern to them. They don't want to discuss it. They're angry if you're trying to bring it in. You say, what Bush, if somebody says, well, look, I think this Bush thing is dangerous to all of us. We don't discuss politics here. Right? Hitler's coming in with his armies. He's going to invade the United States. Here they're on the beaches. They're coming in. We don't discuss politics here. And that's what that tends to do. This Lord of the Rings and that kind of thing among adolescents will actually destroy their ability to respond to moral problems. Now, on Bush going in March, look, don't assume that Bush has intentions. That is, not rational intentions. What Bush is, look at the way he operates. I mean, a man who read three words, which he didn't write, and said them simply because they were on a computer screen, is not an intellectual giant. Access of evil. That's not a giant. What he does is he responds. We know this. We know this from all kinds of people in society. And you see it in Bush repeatedly. He responds emotionally with conviction to totally irrational conceptions. There's no rationality to what he's saying, what he's doing. But he adopts it. Now, he therefore is influenced by what? Bush's behavior as governor of Texas and as president so far is characterized by a domination of a personality by one thing: habits of style. He uses words, phrases, and so forth in a certain way, according to a certain style of reaction. I made up my mind, therefore it's going to happen. Style. I said these words, therefore they're my policy. Style. Now, one of the styles he's adopted, despite his quarrels with some of these people who he's having problems with, like McCain, and don't overrate Bush and ignore McCain. Don't overrate Lieberman. That's a real case of evil on your hands. And he's not as dumb as Bush. He's clever. He's dangerous. McCain is much more dangerous. He's a real Manchurian. He's a hand grenade rolling in our political process. And he might go off at any time. So when Bush is going to Peru and talk about, if he's going to talk about putting up something in a base in the jungle, he's reacting with style of putting up U.S. military bases as an expression of his sexual pleasure in exerting power. Yeah? I mean, this is like a Caligula phenomenon. The expression of power for the sake of power. The imposition of a style of imposing power for the sake of doing it. Adopting phrases because he likes the phrase and makes the phrase a policy even though he doesn't know what it means. And then insists upon it, enforces it. So that's your problem. Now, in terms of Peru's future, there's only one hope for Peru. There are no Peruvian solutions. There is a Peruvian role in a solution, but not a Peruvian solution. There's nothing at this point Peru can do. Peru lost its sovereignty with a legalized coup d'etat which threw Fujimori out of government. That was a coup d'etat orchestrated by the United States government with the backing of the drug lobby, which had a big interest in this operation. Soros, for example, drug lobby. Now, what Peru can be a modern society, we worked on this question of its possible development. It has everything needed to become a successful modern nation state, as does Argentina, in effect. The question is how do we get the combination of power in reorganizing the international financial system to a reform which makes this possible. Under those conditions, there is no limit to the rate of development of Peru. It has jungle which it has not tapped, really. It has water resources it's not begun to develop. It has all kinds of potentialities. It has a people with a certain history and a sense of integrity. It's a nation, a real nation, and it can do good things. It has an internal cadre, an intelligentsia, which is respectable and can do things, can make decisions. It's a cultured nation in terms of a nation as a whole. Under the right conditions, it can do everything. South and Central America, was referred to as Mesoamerica by Marvilla earlier today, it can do a great deal. What it needs is a system in which to do it. And what we need to have is a sense of solidarity among the nations of the Americas, among the leaders of the nations of Americas, and just say we're going to do it. We have to get the power to go ahead and do it. And that's our job.
Now, I'm told that Rafi de Jesus or de Jesus had a question for Helga at the student panel earlier. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, actually is directed to Lyndon. Sorry about that. I just wanted to say that I got your back. I just want to say that you're such an inspiration for my youth and, for example, myself, because I've always been into politics, but as a kid, I've always been into video games also, and I decided to study computer animation. But, like, ever since I heard about you, I've been going with my my ambition in political science. So I just want to commend you on that for sticking up to what you believe in and giving us, you know, youth, the youth of today, like, the right, you know, to go with what we think is right instead of what we think will be fun. My question... My question was really, earlier you said that we should go out and, you know, talk to the youth, not only the youth, but the people on what's going on in the world. And you were speaking on deployment and stuff like that. But something I came up with like the help of the group I came with in New Jersey is that people, human beings, we really don't go with what we hear as much as what we see. You know, and it's great that, you know, you're speaking to us and we know what you're all about. We know what we're all about. And, you know, we support you all the way. But what about the people that don't know about you? Right now, you're like the Kaiser Soze of politics. You know, they hear great things about you, but they're like, who's Lyndon? You know, where I'm from in my borough, you know, my where I live at, I speak about you a lot. You're like God, you know? Everybody that knows me, oh, here comes Ralphie. He's going to start talking about Lyndon, you know, and on politics. You know, but is that I want I want my friends and everybody in my community to know about you, because the things that are happening now in the United States, as we all know, it's just atrocious, you know? We have to do something about this. And I want to know, like, in your part, like, what are you doing, like, to go into communities like in the Bronx, in Manhattan, not only that, but, like, places like in the South where, you know, racism is just, like, second nature to them, you know? Like, we need people like yourself, you know, or your group to just go out and start talking to people, not only through, like things like what we're doing right now, but also through TV. I understand that the government has been spending like millions of dollars just to keep you out of the media, but there has to be a way that we have to fight that to get you to the media, because like I said, people only believe in what they see with their eyes. So they could hear all these great things, but as long as they don't see it, as long as they don't see you, I think a lot of people don't even know what you look like, you know. So there's, we have to do something about that, you know, because that's a problem. So in all favors, what can we do to show people what you're all for, and show people, you know, what you have done, and spread your word out? I know deployment is good, but deployment is not all that. You know, we need to show people. We need to show them what you're doing.
Well, you know, there's a process in history, and you cannot abstract yourself from the process and imagine how you could work under any condition. You have to locate yourself in the process in which you found yourself. There is at the present moment a great change occurring in politics, social movements, and other things worldwide. And this weekend's event featured, at least my instigation, the question of the cluster bust. And the cluster is busting. The slime mold is disintegrating, and it's not becoming very popular. We get pictures of that slime mold on television, at least on our television, and we get people to see that that is what they're talking about when they're talking about Enron. Oh, that's a disgusting thing. How do we get rid of it? How do we ever get it on our backs? Is it in our cellars, perhaps? We better clean the refrigerator. There might be some of that in there. Things like that. So we come to a time in which we have certain pagan gods which have ruled the United States. One is the mass media. And what is the mass media? As I've said before, simply, shortly, the United States is ruled by a combination of a financier group, large major law firms like those in Washington and New York and so forth, large accounting firms, which function just like law firms do, as enforcers, as we see in the Anderson case and these cases Enron, and then a mass media which is controlled by the same thing. The entire mass media of the United States is controlled top down by a fascist political animal, called the mass media. This includes what? Not only television, not only major newspapers and magazines, not only networks as such, as well as the mass media as such, but also mass entertainment, which has a much greater influence on the mentality of the American population than the so-called mass news media. It is not the lies told by the mass news media which are the primary driver of the corruption of the morals and mind of the American people. It is mass entertainment. And if you want to understand how the mass news media works to corrupt and destroy the morals of people who become addicted to it, just as it's almost another version of Nintendo games, what is done in the news media is to replicate the mass entertainment media as a so-called news media. If you study it, you recognize that very easily. Just look at it. There is no mass news media. Once we had what we called a mass news media in the 1950s, 1960s, even into the 1970s. Well, in the 1990s, the mass news media disappeared. Walter Cronkite is still alive, 85 years old, and off someplace doing something still. But Cronkite and the evening news, the CBS evening news, it doesn't exist anymore. News broadcasts like that don't exist. Newspapers, they have become totally degenerate. They play into, with a few little, you know, communications underneath the tablecloth, so to speak, in the Washington Post and so forth. You can pick things out of there, which is symptomatic. But it's that's the problem. So, but the people sense that you can't do anything in politics unless you can crack into the mass media, including the TV media. But look, as I said before, earlier this weekend, what is the characteristic of the mass entertainment media? What is the characteristic of so-called American democracy? American democracy is a disgusting, immoral thing. It is crisis in democracy. It is project democracy. It is a controlled Congress in which both the Republican and Democratic Party are controlled by the project democracy, which runs both parties from the top down on national policy issues. It's orchestrated. It's Big Brother. But what's the other characteristic of it? The characteristic of mass entertainment is the mass is mass entertainment. It is a replication in the modern electronic and other forms of what? It's a replication of the Roman arena, the pagan Roman arena. It's blood in circuses. Vox populi and popular opinion are the same thing. They are as in ancient Rome. They are controlled by the mass entertainment media, including the bodily contact sports, such as the so-called rock video media, which is another strange form of bodily contact sports, or unbodily contact sports, if you keep watching them long enough. So that's where the problem is. We have to recognize, therefore, that the strategy for victory against these enemies does not lie in trying to seduce them into being nice to me. They will not do that. They will not do that. They never have and they never will. I'm the enemy. Why should they be seduced by me? They hate me. They would like to obliterate the very notion that I exist. They have spent a great deal of money to that effect. It hasn't fully succeeded, but they spent a lot on it. And our people who work with this complain about the fact you are being obliterated by the media. Well, that's deliberate, buddy. But what happens on the day that the mass media loses its authority? Then you have new politics. So the only way you can do this, and you have to have a sense of the power of ideas to do that, not a sense of what the postures ought to be. The only way you can do that is be patient. Terribly patient. Awfully patient. And awfully impatient at the same time. You have to realize the system is coming down. The new economy is dead. It was a farce and it's now dead. The market, so-called, which was a god. You get in the Congress, people, what do they talk about? The market. What are the congressmen talking about? The market. How's the market doing? They were high or low in emotions that day based on the market. How's the market doing? The god called the market is about to die. What is the mass media devoted to largely? The so-called news media. It's largely Wall Street. It's the market. What do you see on the evening news? Or the daily news, or the all-day news? The market, the market, the market. What's happening to the market? They say everything, there's a recovery in progress. Oh, Dracula's back again. There is no recovery. It's collapsing. When the institution of the so-called recovery, the eternal Dracula, is discredited, when these other institutions are discredited, that is the time that a people suddenly, and they're doing it now, we're getting a lot of indications of it, they're doing it now, they've come out of the ether, and they go to new ways of responding, new ways of thinking, new ways of responding. The trick is to be there. Now, what Raphael has mentioned, which is true, is that the weakness in this organization, and I've been complaining about it for a long time, for about 20 odd years, in fact, the weakness in this association has been a resistance to a policy of outreach. The tendency has been for people to try to organize by going out and saying the latest news is the following. And by peddling the news to get some sexual excitement into what you have to say. I'm talking about, did you hear the latest? 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 So you're following events, not making them. Outreach consists of talking to people in terms of forecasting, of saying, here's what is happening now. You know that, don't you? Of course. Here's what is about to happen. You know that, don't you? You don't agree, do you? Huh? Well, you're wrong, but you don't agree. I know you don't agree. You believe in this nonsense, don't you? And it's coming down. Here's how it's going to come down. You want to know? That's how you organize. And that's not that simple, but that's a succinct summation of what must be done. You have people out there who are divorced from reality. They don't understand what's going on in the world. They say, I can't understand this stuff. I can't be involved. Most of the American voters are not involved in politics. They've turned away from the parties. They're out there. Nobody pays any attention to them. People pay attention to people who are likely to vote. That's what the politicians pay attention to. Who is likely to vote? Politics and propaganda is based on addressing those who they think are likely to vote. What is the condition of most Americans? They are unlikely to vote. Nobody pays any attention to them, and they pay no attention to themselves. They sit there and they suffer like slaves who have no rights at the big white master's house. Our job is to get the slaves into revolt. The slaves are those who are not organized, who are not moving, who are inert, because they don't see there's any possibility they could make it. They just want to survive. They want to roll over that credit card account. They want to hope that they don't lose their mortgage. They want to hope that they don't lose all the jobs. They're desperate and frightened. They're numb, intellectually numb, with the situation in which they find themselves, the hopelessness of it. Somebody has to go out and inspire them to see the situation is not hopeless, it's only desperate. And what's needed is that outreach.
You've been listening to EIR Talks, presenting Lyndon LaRouche speaking to the Schiller Institute Conference on February 16, 2002. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.